This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Now, as we take a look at the history of rock and roll, and we take a look at the history of popular music, it's interesting that we've got a little bit of Percy Grainger playing. Joining me in the studio is David Nicholls, who's the author of Dig, Australian Pop and Rock Music from 1960 to 1985. Today we're going back a little bit and taking a look at the influence as well. David, good morning.
Good morning.
David, why is Percy Grainger significant to Australian popular music?
Grainger was, you know, a very talented pianist, and he toured the world. So he was internationally famous, mainly as a performer rather than as a composer, although, you know, he did compose a lot. The reason that I thought Grainger was really interesting was that he was an innovator in lots of ways. He tried to capture a kind of what he saw as a kind of Australian, I guess, landscape sensibility, particularly in his very experimental music, and what we just heard was not an example of that.
Mm.
If anybody is in Melbourne and is able to go to the Grainger Museum, which is an amazing, extraordinary, wonderful cultural institution on my campus at the University of Melbourne. One of the things that they have there is they have examples of recordings that Grainger's sort of experimental noise machines, and he just sort of concocted these bizarre, what do you call them, like automatic noisemakers, which had some kind of ability to modulate the tone and the scope of the sound and so on. And he wanted notes, or not even notes necessarily, but noises to like glide into each other. And he saw this. He was inspired by trips he took as a boy on the train in, you know, I guess the very early 20th century through the countryside. And so
he sort of changed the face of music.
He did so much. He did so many extraordinary things. I mean, he was not, you know, I don't think that his noise machines were massively influential, but it's somebody who is a very successful musician who's trying to push the envelope and doing some quite remarkable things in the 30s, 40s and 50s that, you know, he had fingers in a lot of pies. And some of the pies that Percy Grainger favoured were not necessarily everybody's cup of tea.
Was he open to changes in music and what was happening
very
in the music scene?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, if anyone, like, just a little, like, dabble a little bit in the history of Percy Grainger, he's an extraordinary figure. And he had some really disgusting quirks in his personality. He was quite a horrible person in some ways. And he was incredibly racist, but at the same time he was fascinated by non-Western music. So he was a collector of non-Western musics, and he saw it all as a big smorgasbord that he could pick from and look at and explore and collect.
As we saw the advent of rock and roll and that move into modern music, did he like that?
He loved it.
Yeah.
Apparently, in his last decade or so of life, he was. I can't remember precisely when he died. I think it was in the mid-50s. He lived in New York, and he saw, to a certain degree, he saw rock and roll as a kind of a realization of his interest in electronic music, which we might not necessarily see it that way these days. We look at that early rock and roll and we go, that's pretty analog.
Hmm.
But he saw, you know, electrically amplified instruments and so on. He saw as a kind of an aspect of things that he'd been exploring decades before, being used in popular music. And he was, you know, one thing about Grainger. I mean, he produced what I guess we would call light classical, you know, music. And he played piano. He was a pianist, and he was a touring pianist, and he played to popular audiences. But he was very into popular music. He was very into blues and so on as well, and jazz.
If that's the case, was he influential of people around the 50s that were leading into rock and roll like folk and jazz? Was he influential to other musicians that people recognised his influence?
Possibly in Australia, his influence might have more been people going, well, an Australian can be huge internationally, whatever they're doing musically. I don't know that he had an enormous impact in that sense. But then you do find, like, odd little things. I mean, in his, one of his, I think he's had two autobiographies. Barry Humphries talks about visiting the Granger Museum when he's a youngster, and he's very interested in the absurdist elements of what Granger is doing, and he's sort of fascinated by Granger himself as a performer. So Humphries is not a musician per se, but he does have a huge impact on the way that Australians see themselves and the way that Australians present themselves. So in that sense, I think when you look at the influence of someone like Granger, you go, well, there's weird little things happening. I mean, he's a massive figure in the first half of the 20th century and very successful and very popular.
If this case, so who else were the influences on Australian music and Australian popular music at that stage? Was country music then influential as well?
Country music was quite big, I think, in the 40s and 50s. And there's a kind of when we look back at that time, I think we're looking back with, major hindsight. We're looking back through the kind of ways that music has been typified, by people compiling playlists for commercial radio, in the last 20 or 30 years. So there's that idea of hillbilly music and so on that's probably seen in the 40s and 50s as quite, a novelty and a little bit, sweet and funny and silly, but maybe not something that you'd really take to your heart.
But leading into the popular music thing, like with Slim Dusty, I presume, like with Pub With No Beer, that it's moving into that popular music realm.
I reckon, and I think that also when you look at that kind of stuff, it's music that's easy to replicate. So, Slim Dusty or the thousand other, Slim Dusty wannabes could go and, play in a small hall or play in a pub or whatever, so that there's, you can travel with your guitar and not much else, and you can do quite a bit as a performer. So in a way, I guess what I'm saying is that there's an element of it is how transportable are you? Yep. How easy is it for you to get around? All of that kind of stuff I think factors in too. So someone, a performer in the 50s might get up and say, oh, I'm going to do a couple of country numbers, I'm going to do a couple of, folk song, maybe even Australian folk songs. I'm going to, here's a little, blues number, here's a silly nursery rhyme. Mm. You never know what people might string together as a set, but they may not be so stuck in their, in formats or genres.
Was it American music that had the biggest influence on rock and roll coming into the, from the 50s into Australia, or did English music have as much of an influence? Or did English music perhaps come later?
Well, remember that before the Beatles, everybody thought rock and roll was an American music.
Yep.
Like, there was no such thing as English, the idea of English rock and roll was perverse, bizarre. Nobody was going to talk about that. There was The Shadows or whatever. So there was a little bit, but really, and that probably had a bit of currency in Australia. But I think effectively you're looking at an American music, and you're also looking, of course, at a young, very young person's music, and you're looking at a kind of music that people are saying, this is disgusting, this is an awful, I've used the word disgusting twice in the last 10 minutes, sorry, but this is a terrible, degraded, nonsense music.
It's the advent of teenagers at the same
time. Teenagers, exactly, that's right. And, all that stuff, Marlon Brando, whatever, James Dean, all of those kinds of things that come in at the same time.
Did people like Lee Gordon have a big influence on that in touring people here and bringing people to Australia?
I gather that he did. Lee Gordon is a really extraordinary figure, an American, probably, all due respect, and he was quite a remarkable guy, but he probably wouldn't have been such a strong presence had he stayed in the States, but being in Australia and being this kind of quite unique figure and also having the connections and having the ability and all of that kind of stuff. I think he was, once again, he's the kind of person that you'd, as a promoter, he made a record, I think, but he, at least one, but so he was a bit of a character and a personality himself. But I think that Lee Gordon is the kind of guy that you'd say, people would look at him and go, well, you can actually be extraordinary and bizarre. And, the famous story about Lee Gordon that I put in my book was that he thought he was going to die, so he had a party with a coffin in the, as the centrepiece of the party, which he, got in and out of and stuff, and he was, kind of, you'll see me here permanently soon kind of stuff.
Phil, good morning.
Good morning, Trev. Just wanted to let you know, Trev, in 29th of October 2014, I hosted the very last concert of the Probus Brothers. The Probus Brothers were a duo of Bruce and Barry Probus from Grafton originally, moved to Newcastle in the 50s, and we were doing a video promo before they came on stage this night. They're both in their 80s. They were the oldest duo working in the world, a total of about 166 years, the two of them, well in their 80s.
Wow.
But still performing brilliantly. In the 70s, they became famous for all of their Leyland Brothers theme songs they wrote and recorded here in Newcastle.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Travel All Over the Countryside, Uxaleeland. They wrote all of those songs, but they also had something very significant. They were the very first group to write a song with the word rock in it.
Oh.
Going back in the days of Grafton, the ABC Amateur Hour, they were on that with Chad Morgan and all those guys, they won that. But they wrote a song called The Jacaranda Rock, because that's their hometown, Grafton. They wrote this song called The Jacaranda Rock, and it became the first song in Australia to have the word rock in it.
And I presume, like, recorded in Australia.
And they, yeah, no one else had a song with the word rock in it.
Yeah.
But, so the Probus Brothers, they seen what was happening in America, I suppose, and then they thought, oh, well, I'll write the first song here, and they wrote this song and recorded it. In 2014, in April, they were inducted into the Australian Music Hall of Fame in Canberra. The government took them down there, give them 3 days down there. They have a big recording studio there at Canberra. They give them a day in the studio there. They recorded 30 of their original songs. They didn't record a real lot of songs. That Jacaranda Rock was their first one they recorded, and they might have recorded a couple of others, but their biggest fame,
yep,
name to fame was all of those Leyland Brothers songs, where in the early 90s, an album came out called the Gold Selection Album, the best 59 television themes to ever written for Australian television, and they got number one,
yeah,
two, and three.
It would have to have been. Look, Phil, thank you.
Thanks, Phil.
The early years of rock. Who were the other who were the people that were doing it in the early 50s? Because there are a couple of things there. There's also the early record labels that were coming out, and basically really coming out of Sydney and Melbourne.
Yeah, yeah. There's quite a lot of names. Many of them sadly lost. You know, Provost Brothers. That's a great one. I think a lot about Jade Hurley. He's an early one, and he comes out of the Johnny O'Keefe kind of umbrella sphere of influence. So Johnny O'Keefe and 6 o'clock Rock, producing quite a lot of people. Many of them one hit wonders, and some of them with really fascinating careers. Dig Richards is one that springs to mind as well, who was a solo performer in that kind of vein. A lot of those people in the late 50s, they start out, they get their entree into the popular consciousness through rock and roll, and then they go, okay, well, actually, I've got many strings to my bow, so I can go into the cabaret circuit or whatever, and I can be all kinds of singer.
Because it was a blurring
performer.
Time, wasn't it? Because we had, yeah. I mean, when you look at overseas, you had Johnny Cash, who was recognised as popular music and rock and roll, verging on that. You had Elvis. There are all sorts of people, and I presume it blurred the same way in Australia as well.
Yeah, definitely. I hesitate to bring up the name, but Rolf Harris is a guy who I think however we may feel about him, more recently in the 21st century, and he was a real phenomenon in the 50s into the 60s, and beyond. And one of the things that he did, which was fascinating from our point of view now, is he had some big hits. One of which, Sunrise, I think that's early 60s. Mm. That was a ostensibly, and it wasn't actually an Aboriginal song, and he didn't claim that it was, but he, in fact, he made steps to make sure everyone knew that it wasn't, but it had that kind of influence to it in some ways, and so he's, I guess, that's really a fascinating thing. Something comes into the pop charts as a, referencing Aboriginal music and culture in a very very strong and unabashed way, that kind of thing. And I guess if we're looking at a performer who wants to make a uniquely Australian style of music, and of course Rolf Harris made his name in the UK, and he was also very successful in Australia for 40, 50 years as an Australian. Everybody knew that's what he was. I mean, he was without any doubt. There was no doubt about that. So, and he was, I mean, in a way, he was sort of making, you know, I think he saw himself primarily as an artist, as a visual artist, as a painter, and he just happened to have this second ability to make records, made a lot of records with George Martin and stuff like that.
We'll go to some calls, and then we'll talk about Bandstand, because television was very significant as well. Hello, Sava.
G'day, sorry to come back again, but
you're right.
In 1955, we made a record with a fella called Richard Gray with Phillips. It was produced by Gabby Rogers, who was the Phillips musical director, who I met quite by accident. I was on patrol at Collaroy, and I walked past him and his wife, and they had two Dalmatian dogs that attacked me. We started the conversation, and I was singing in a group called the Four Brothers, and this was in 1955. We'd just been on the Amateur Hour, and I think the Provost Brothers were on it, and we ran second. And we were picked up by Jack Neary, and we started singing, and then Gabby Rogers got us to come in, and we backed Richard Gray.
Mm-hmm.
And David Kilby and Geordie Kilby, they were talking about this one day, and I rang them up, and it was established that that was the first rock and roll record ever made in Australia. And it was made on Phillips, and we sang Maybelline, Gumdrop, and another couple. It was a 45. So, Richard, I know you're only recording things from 60 on, but the biggest shock that came to Australia as far as rock and roll was concerned was Bill Haley.
Oh, yeah.
And he shocked all the musos, I think, when he came out. There was a movie, and I can't think of the movie that song was in. It was like a school movie. And that started the rock and roll business. Now, we were then invited by Gabby Rogers to go in and record a few songs, just the Four Brothers. The day we arrived at the studio, which was in York Street, I think it was that AWA tower on top of it, the day that we arrived there to record the songs, our lead singer, Mick Beasley, was shanghaied by some Swedish sailors and went to Sweden on a freight boat, and that was the end of the Four Brothers.
Seven, thank you. And it could have been so big.
That's a sad story, but an extraordinary story.
Bandstand, I think, started in the late 50s and went for a long time.
Mm.
How influential was television and the bands and the acts that came in at that time?
You know, television, amazing, extraordinarily influential and very useful. Because, and you see this, I mean, you see this to this day, actually. You've got all those channels, you've got to fill them up with something and a bit of live entertainment. You have people who can, are probably hungry, want the exposure. So, I have no idea what the financial arrangements are, but they're probably, you know, not necessarily that great for the performers. But thousands and thousands of people will see you, and you can, you know, say, well, I'm playing at place X tomorrow night. So, I think that there's that aspect to it, that it's cheap, you know, for television. To have popular music shows, and there are a lot of them. And also, when you look at the kind of the people who come up through the ranks as hosts and so on, there's a lot of people that still household names today. I'm thinking immediately of Bert Newton, but household names today who started as kind of hosts of pop shows in the 50s, possibly transitioning from radio into television that way.
Yeah, as a lot of people did.
Yeah, yeah. And there's, of course, radio is huge as well, but but TV is, you know, it's just Australians embrace TV massively, instantly, and, you know, partly, I suppose, because they're denied it for so long, and they get it quite late in the amongst Western countries.
And a lot of those things, they basically were miming covers. They were miming other people's songs.
Often the case, yeah, yeah. That's Molly Meldrum notoriously got his, not necessarily his start, but, you know, I think that was his first TV exposure was he often did. There's a clip going around of him miming Winchester Cathedral,
yeah,
I think.
I remember that.
Yeah, but so, yes, that's right. And then there was a crackdown on that was stopped. So instead we get Australian acts doing covers, you know, live covers of international hits.
Jerry, good morning.
Yeah, I remember the Bandstand and the Countdown, and Digby Richards, Olivia Newton-John.
Oh, yeah.
Now, who's that fella who transitioned into telly and he did The Price is Right? Remember that fella?
Tony Barber.
Who?
Tony Barber.
No, it's another fella, you know. He used to be on... He used to sing.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. Now,
Ian...
Oh, Ian... Ian Turpey.
Ian Turpey, yes.
That's right, yeah. And he died, unfortunately.
Yes, he did, yes, sadly.
Yeah. So I remember those shows well, you know.
Great. How did you watch them? Did you watch them with your family? Or?
I did, no, just, well, I can't remember watching with my family so much. I've got a big family, too. Three sisters and two brothers, and I'm the second youngest of them. And, yeah, that's Ian Turpey, that's the one I was trying to think of, and he had a pretty prominent role, you know.
And, Jerry, this is also the time of Johnny O'Keefe and 6 o'clock Rock.
That's right. But Olivia Newton-John, definitely.
Yeah. She really cut her teeth as a very... She was very young, I think, when she started on TV.
Yeah. Because Johnny O'Keefe is what... I mean, when I think of Australian rock and roll and Australian popular music, it's Johnny O'Keefe that always comes to mind first.
Yeah, yeah.
And what made him so significant was that he was doing original Australian rock and roll music?
He was... Well, look, you know, I don't want to speak ill of the dead. In inverted commas, he was writing his own stuff. I mean, yeah. I think he was possibly doing a kind of thing where he's saying to his band... you know, string something together, and if I like it, I'll put my name on the credits. I also, he was also indulging in that thing of DJs were allowed to put their names on the credits as well if they played the record, which is, you know, but anyway, but, you know, so Johnny O'Keefe was doing that kind of stuff. I think what was really influential about him, well, he was an amazing self-promoter,
yep.
And I'm not putting him down on that front. I think he did a really great
Plenty
job.
Plenty of people in the music industry,
oh, totally,
yeah.
Totally. And that was, it was a huge thing. And he did it really, really stunningly well. Well, I suppose, I mean, he didn't have a number one hit around the world, but he was just full of ideas, full of amazing ideas for promoting himself. And he was also... a real entrepreneur. So as I said, you know, I mentioned Jade Hurley, you know, that was just Johnny O'Keefe saying to this guy, look, I found a pair of green gloves in the dressing room. You're going to be Jade Hurley from now on. You're going to put these on. You're going to be Jade Hurley. And that, you know, that launched, a talented man's career for another 50 years, really. Mm. And there were plenty of others on 6 o'clock Rock, which was a, you know, kudos to the ABC for making that happen. O'Keefe was, a bizarre personality, and he had a lot of, I'm not going to use the word disgusting again, but he had a lot of quirks that I don't think we'd necessarily find too palatable these days, but or then for that matter.
But he sort of had was he the first Australian to bring that rock and roll image, that sort of hard-living, hard-driving rock and roll guy?
Yeah,
that was
yeah.
one of the things that attracted people to him as well.
I think that's true, and I think that he, and he was also, you know, he was kind of, kind of king of the teenagers as well. I think one of the extraordinary things that you find about O'Keefe is he apparently had a huge amount of trouble getting a record deal because he was seen as quite unrespectable, or you know, not respectable, and he was going to soil the image of any label that signed him. So he. This is a good example of self-promotion. Apparently, he forced Festival Records to take him on as an artist by telling everybody, you know, like telling the press that Festival Records had signed him. So they didn't want to then go, well, that's not true. So apparently, they called him in and gave him a truly awful deal, you know, one penny in, you know, every pound or something. But yes, he was a huge and you know, obviously. Using television, you know, massive thing. And for many of us, we can still conjure his image, you know, to mind.
Oh, you can.
We can remember performances that we've seen.
Nothing else, from the beginning of Rage.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Because
yeah,
it's just kept on going. We'll listen to a bit.
Shaking, baby, I'm a real wild child. I meet all the guys, I'm gonna meet all the chicks. shiver and I shake until I get on my kicks, cause I'm a wild one. Ooh, yeah, I'm a wild one. Ooh, baby, gonna break loose. I'm gonna keep a moving wild. I'm gonna keep a shaking, baby. I'm a real wild child. Get me a chick, cause that's a hole in my home. Shake it till the meat comes off of the bone, cause I'm a wild one.
And that's such a rock and roll sound from that time.
Totally.
Philip, good morning.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
Good, Philip.
Is that Trevor, is it?
Yeah, it is. And David Nichols is the author of Dig, Australian Pop and Rock Music from 60 to 85.
Yeah, I was just laying there and thinking about the parental influence pre-1964. Like, we lived in Tamworth in the 1950s up till about 1961 we left Tamworth. And, you know, like, to listen to Elvis Presley, that was the devil. Both my parents were heavily into the Salvation Army. My father was a Corps Sergeant Major at Tamworth, and my mother was a Home League and all that. And, you know, and I saved up and bought a Elvis Presley record, and my father broke it, immediately broke it. And
that must have made it so attractive.
Yeah, that makes it even more appealing, doesn't it, Philip?
Yeah, well, that does. And then we, you know, I remember we moved up to Caboolture. We bought a small crops farm at Caboolture, and I used to sneak into Brisbane, and Chris, you know, we started to get into what was then called sort of heavy rock and sneak to the Whiskey A Go-Go. I remember going to the Whiskey A Go-Go. And, you know, before all the problems and things like that. But I just thought I'd ring up and mention the unrespectability
totally.
Of these people from your parents. Mm-hmm. And, of course, your parents were much more influential on your life than they are now. You know, parents have sort of given up.
Yeah, and so it's always, there were no Perry Comos. At that time. Mm. Look, thank you very much, Philip. Just as you take a look at that, we've talked about the influences. There were also the venues, and also there was... Then we're starting to see the surf scene, like with the Atlantics in Australia.
Yeah, that's right. And look, I think that it's... What could be a more appropriate music for Australia, you know, that kind of stuff, particularly, you know, Sydney and Perth and stuff with, you can just see that as a real, people embracing that. The Atlantics, and they had their record, their Bombora record, which was huge, pretty, I mean, it's one of those beautiful, I don't know, irony is a word overused, but, you know, the one ocean that Australia just is nowhere near, and they're the apparently they named themselves after a type of petrol or something, which it sounds even stranger, but I guess petrol equals cars equals freedom equals, you know, girls equals beach equals...
Rock and roll.
Rock and roll. So, they were a monster band. They were huge, and they carried on through the 60s and did some really extraordinary things. But yes, they started out as a surf instrumental band. I gather they all met on a bus, you know, in Coogee or somewhere like that, and they're just like, we're going to get it together.
See, because that's again coming from Dick Dale and that sort of sound that was coming through from the States. But there was something very Australian about it as well. It was
it was
almost a strong sound of Australian music.
Yeah, and has continued to be, and you know, even up until the late 60s into the 70s, you have bands like Tamam Shud and stuff who kind of take that stuff and take it one step further into, you know, psychedelic or...
Oh, and then Hoodoo Gurries actually then take
exactly.
it another step
yeah,
as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, that's right. Good point.
Hello, Mark.
Good morning, Trevor and David.
Hi, Mark.
Calling from Adelaide. Grew up with a lot of this music. I was 10 years old in the early 60s.
Mm.
There was people like Bobby Rydell...
Mm.
Robbie G had a big hit with Jezebel, those sort of people. There's a satellite city in Adelaide called Elizabeth where a lot of these bands grew up because they were English people.
Twilights.
Twilights is one, 1964. The Hurricanes and the early Twilights trio joined together to become the Twilights. And you had people in there like Glenn Shorrock, Terry Britton, John Bywaters, legends called... Cold Chisel grew up in Elizabeth.
Yeah.
I've got in my hand here, 5AD was a radio station in the 60s and 70s, Top 300, 1961 to 1970, original copy.
Oh, yeah.
And they put this out, and they were going to play from 300 down to 1, and then 1 up to 300 over a weekend.
Cool.
And there's lots of Australian bands there.
Geez, that outdid the Hottest 100 by a little way,
totally,
didn't it?
Yeah.
I used to go and watch Moonshine Jug and String Band.
Oh, of course.
The early band from the Angels.
Yeah, the Angels.
1973 at the Sussex Hotel in Walkerville. Used to see them on a Thursday night.
And they had hit records too, didn't they, in the early 70s?
Yeah. They had a little song called Germany and one called Ice Cream and things like that. So, really great times. Now, Percy Grainger, his grave is in West Terrace Cemetery in Adelaide.
Oh, is it?
And I walk past there quite often. There's a lot of description around the grave about him. To see some relatives' graves of mine nearby. A little bit of information there for you.
Yeah, cool.
Look, thank you. And it brings up a really important point, is migration into Australia in the 60s and the important influence that had on popular music as well.
Yeah, the Bee Gees is a great example of and I think they're a wonderful example, and they're sort of like, they're pre-rock and roll at the beginning. They're, once again, like Olivia, they're incredibly young in the early 60s, and they come here from, well, basically Manchester via the Isle of Man, and they just suddenly launch themselves as like a triple threat, you know, and they, particularly Barry at that stage, and then the other two brothers are writing their own songs, and that's really extraordinary for the time.
Yeah.
And when you listen to those early songs, they make TV. TV is, you know, just like, it's their bread and butter, and they're on TV all the time, apparently, and they're in the studio all the time, which is something else. Those early songs are often pretty terrible, but that's okay. I mean, in a way, they're learning their craft in public, which I think is...
And they were very hard workers, too.
Apparently they were. I think their father cracked the whip a bit.
Yeah, might a little bit. Mm. Jill, good morning.
Hello.
Yes, Jill. Hey,
Jill.
Well, I'm in my 80s, but in the... When rock and roll first started, and the Bandstand in particular, your young man there has no idea of the amount of money was around at the time, because everybody was paid, you know, in the 50s, Australia was really bouncing along, and my husband played was a trumpet player, and he was also arranged most of the music for Bandstand.
Wow.
And Johnny O'Keefe shows and all those sorts of things. Money was really available because most of the TVs didn't, the TV stations didn't want to know that, they didn't want to they didn't want tax people around. Shall we say?
Okay. So they paid everything by cash.
Whoa.
Yes. Or gold bars. We bought a Mercedes at one stage in the 50s, and we didn't have time to put all the checks in the thing, so we paid the whole thing off by checks. I think he's too young to really understand and needs to do a lot more work about how society was at that time.
Jill, the thing is, though, we're actually taking a look at the history of the music at the time, not necessarily the society or how people were paid. But thank you.
No, it's a good point. I mean, I guess I'm going by what people like Johnny O'Keefe said.
Yeah.
And, of course, it would make sense for him to be saying, I'm barely paid anything.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're you know, and filling up the basement with... pounds and pennies.
Brian has said, was Jimmy Little the first Indigenous popular musician?
I think that's true, yeah.
Yeah, because that was, what, Royal Telephone was late 50s?
No, I think it was early 60s.
Was it early
60s? But Jimmy Little came on the scene, you know, he had a presence, yeah, totally. He was certainly the first really popular one.
Wendy, good morning.
Oh, good morning. I was just talking about music, and this was in the 50s, and I was 16. I was allowed to go to dancing classes, but I wasn't allowed to go to surf club ones because they're unruly.
Oh, yeah, of course.
At City Beach Surf Club, which I was a member, young, I was a young belonged to the club as a lifesaver. And they used to have the Widgies and Bodgies.
Of course.
Go there on the Friday night. And I was forbidden to go, but I used to be able to get a lift down there. And the women had all these short haircuts, very short at the back, with what they called the duck's tail.
Mm.
And it was just the most exciting and lovely place to be. But The dancing was absolutely marvellous.
See, the venue, it was a really important thing associated with the rock and roll movement, and in Australia, was the dances that were had right across the country.
Yes, huge.
And the, because there was also, because I was reading that they extended the hours at hotels as well in New South Wales to allow for the dances and to for allow for rock and roll in the late 50s and early 60s too. Jeff actually wanted to talk about the same thing. Hello, Jeff.
Hi. Yeah, we ran a dance in Cahoona in northern Victoria.
Okay.
And we've actually got a website called Rock and Roll, Cahoona Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
And did you have local, like Australian acts?
Yes, and our local band was the Lonely Ones. And they used to back everybody, like the Bee Gees and Johnny Chester and Robbie G was actually our first artist we had.
Yeah.
Right.
And we had all the Deltones going right back early rock and roll. And we used to get big crowds in a little town of 2,000 people. We could get up towards 1,000 people in the hall.
Isn't that extraordinary? Where do they all come from?
We used to be able to get them from Sydney, Melbourne.
Wow.
Because we ran a circuit of Cahoona, St Arnett, Kyabram and Bendigo. Right. And we'd get the artists cheap and give them a whole week's work.
Actually, Deltones is a good example as well for that time.
Very good example, yeah.
Good morning, Graham.
Morning, Jeff. How are you?
Good, Graham.
Morning, David.
Hi.
As a boy in the late 50s, early 60s, the Capitol Theatre at Bankstown, Saturday night, place to be. Old Joy, Barry Stanton, Bonnie Lee, Warren Williams, Lucky Starr.
Yeah.
If I got a minute, I'll tell you a quick story about Lucky Starr. I was in the Navy, and during the Vietnam War, we used to operate out of the American Naval Base in Subic Bay, and they had a big enlisted men's club there, and Lucky Starr was billed to... as the support act for the late Roger Miller. At any rate, on the night, Roger Miller was that drunk. One song fell off the stage. Lucky Starr came back on, and he carried the show for 2 hours.
Whoa.
He had the American Sailor stand on chair. That's brilliant.
Good on you. Thanks for the call. The next we're going to take, we'll take a look closer into the 60s, but if you go like from the 50s and into the 60s, the easy beats are so important at that time, and especially for Australian music.
Definitely. Well, once again, like the Bee Gees, they're immigrants, but also like the Bee Gees, they produce their own stuff. And that's a big thing that comes in the 60s. And you think about like the 50s, it seems to me to be, it's often people going, well, you know, I've got my set together of, you know, I like this song, I like this song, I like, you know, you'll know this one, you know, the popular things from the time. And whereas in the 60s, people start to go, yeah, well, I'm writing a new song. It's a change in that way.
We start to see the Seekers being successful overseas and in Australia as well.
Good example of a band that, they come out of the folk movement, which is something we haven't even really talked about much.
Yep.
But they become folk singers. They actually have their roots in rock and roll, I gather. Like the guys in the Seekers had some kind of, you know, rock band or rock and roll band, and then they were like, no, that's not where it's at. You know, where it's at is bringing together maybe some Australian folk classics and some English ones and some possibly even some other, you know, trad jazz kind of stuff.
Then
we'll have this folk group called the Seekers. So that's their origins, and they bring Judith Durham in.
It's a great point for us to actually kick off when we talk next as we go into the 60s.
Yeah.
And then as it progresses with Vander and Young coming out of the Easy Beats, there's so much for us to talk about.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you, David.
Oh, thanks.
David Nichols is the author of Dig, Australian Pop and Rock Music from 1960 to 1985. This is Overnights.